Well, hi everybody and welcome. This is Dave. I'm excited about doing our series and I really appreciate your interest and engagement. I want to keep an open mic for the first few minutes of discussion for each of the seminars and come back on for discussion for a few minutes at the end. So I want to say a couple of things and then ask you if you have something to add or ask. I'm really eager to begin this collaboration with you of something I think is really, really important of what we do as mentor coaches. There's a lot of information, and I want to share with you the outline. You've probably seen it at the page you were directed to. You can download the outline. It's an annotated outline, and there are resources and exercise documents at the end that I think you'll find helpful, and then I'll be referring to a few of them. So I'd suggest printing it so you'll have it as a reference. As I mentioned in the announcement, this is being recorded for online playback. The ports are at that same page you were sent when you downloaded the outline. So my hope is to co-create with you in this collaboration a peak experience in itself, and I will do my best to reserve time for questions, clarifications, and a brief discussion at the beginning and the end of each of the seminars. You probably saw an email I sent around asking a couple of questions for you to reflect on and send to me as soon as you have any kind of specific answer. What's the most important question you want answered during this seminar series? The pressing question you have. That will help me orient and guide some of the discussion and maybe even case illustrations. Second question, for your optimum benefit, what would be your best takeaway 4 weeks from now from this series? Anyone want to check in and answer either or both of those right now? If you haven't had a chance to see my earlier email, I sent it fairly late because I just got the registrations recently. Any answer to any of either of those two questions? But one at a time. What's the main thing? What's the main reason you signed up for this thing? What would you really like to take away? And think about it. These are the two questions we ask our clients. What would you really like to focus on? And what do you want to take away at the end of our discussion? Same process. I'm interested in what would be of most benefit to you. Any responses?
Hi, David. I can chime in if you'd like.
This is
Allison.
Thank you. Go
this
ahead.
Is Allison Legato. Hi.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. I had specifically a question. I'm sure everyone else has a similar question. I'm excited to learn about, I understand, of course, that there are tools and methods to use to help rewire and replace some of the reactions with responses and be more intentional. I'm specifically interested in the systems with which to implement those tools. And in my scenario, and I'm sure in many others, I have a work environment that is very high pressure and very immediate. And so in scenarios, you know, when there's a little bit more time and a little bit more padding to kind of slow things down, I can understand how some of these tools would really function well. But if you're just starting off and things happen really fast, I'm curious and excited to learn about how to build some systems for a pretty, you know, rapid fire, learning process. To
okay.
Make some changes in your responses.
Great question. Thank you. Now, the framework of what we're going to be discussing is not just how the mind and brain and performance sciences work, but the framework of how we as a mentor coach can facilitate a conversation with a client to engage and to really be a catalyst for change. And I think you used a key word about system. If you want to focus on change, don't look just at the goal. Basically, everybody has the same goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. Focus on the system. So that's exactly what we're going to do, is to look at a systematic way of going about creating change. And we already know that information, data, facts are not how you change somebody's mind. We'll get into that a little bit more. So that's an excellent question. And I'm sure each of you have specific applications, perhaps in addition to working with a mentor coaching client. But that's kind of our focus, and I think the application will be extended and obvious, and then we can touch on that. So thanks for that. Any other input or questions right now? Well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode then, and I'll come off lecture mode for discussion at the end. So jot down any questions or anything you want to elaborate or discuss a little bit more at the end. So I'll put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about the background noise. We're going to talk in our first seminar about stress mastery strategies and tools. A quick little story of application, then we'll talk about the principles. I was in the single ski lift line at Steamboat, about to get to the chairlift, and an instructor behind me had five little girls, all about age 5 or 6, ask me if I would mind if two of them rode on the chairlift with me. I said, of course, and I welcomed the opportunity. I love talking to kids. We got on the lift. There were two girls with me. The little girl next to me had kind of an awkward seating and kind of slumped a little bit as we were riding and talking. As we got closer to the end of the lift to ski out of the chair, she said in a really timid voice and kind of turned to me to have the other little girl not here, hopefully. She said, I'm scared to get off. And I said, well, I understand. And I said, do you know who Laurie Hernandez is? It was just after the Olympics when Laurie had won a gold and a silver and was all over the news. So the little girl looked at me and said, yeah. I asked if she would like to know what Laurie did when she was scared about performing her routine. She immediately said, yeah. I told her that Laurie did three things, and I knew I didn't have my usual 364 words per sentence because jumping off the chairlift was real close. I said, Laurie pictures herself doing a perfect routine, a vision, a snapshot of exactly how she's going to perform. Then the instant before she begins, she takes a deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension, and then says to herself, I got this. Well, my new little buddy seemed kind of interested in this and sat a little bit more upright. We were just a few seconds from getting off the lift, and I asked her, well, was she going to say anything to herself as she got off? She said, I got this. And I nudged her. I said, say it like you mean it. Then, in a voice that seemed to channel all of her 5.5 years into somebody I would not want to meet in a dark alley, she said very confidently, I got this. So she skied out of the chair perfectly and then stopped and turned to look at me from about 10 feet away. At the same instant, we both did a 1-inch air fist bump. We both smiled and she skied off with her instructor. So let's sort of do the backstory here. A brief overview of what we're going to be talking about in this seminar about stress mastery strategies and tools. In the last very few years, we've seen revolutionary knowledge of the mind and brain and performance sciences to apply new tools and to engineer optimum performance. So I want to synthesize and integrate these in a practical way for you as mentor coaches. Neuroscientists estimate that about 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. This means the vast majority of our usual responses through the day of how we think, feel, behave are on established algorithms for behavioral, emotional, attachment patterns. This operating system ghostwrites beliefs, emotions, patterns of behavior, attachment, the shadow story that operates on unconscious autopilot. It's the default mode. We don't have to think about it. Now, a script refers to this default mode of expectations, experiences, and responses of how we write our story, or at least it's one way to talk about it. Our expectations inform attachment and behavior patterns that result in usual, typical, even stereotypical responses to certain situations. When we repeat patterns or behaviors, our brain hardwires those as the default mode. So the script for each scenario in our lives operates usually without conscious thought. Think about a family gathering, a board meeting. We tend to sit at the same place every time. We look over the menu, but then are probably the same thing. So to deconstruct a system, to understand the algorithms of patterns of attachment, relationships, performance, behavior, we have to examine this default mode, the script. Change involves breaking the script. So what I'm describing here is a perspective of listening to what your client is telling you. Listen for the story and what they're automatically assuming and deciding and behaving. Now, we can engage in self-directed neuroplasticity to create new behavior side by side with unlearning old automatic behavior. And this is what we do in our engagement with clients. This approach to changing behavior that works also can be considered for what you're doing with your personal stories. Now, I've included at the back of the four seminar outlines two systems to apply to stress mastery and optimum performance. We're going to go through these in more detail, but just as a heads up here, the neuroconditioning chart is a systematic way to identify stressful emotional triggers and to rewire planned ideal responses for best performance. I have a case that I'll briefly give you an overview of what initiated on the front end thinking about and developing this system. Now, the roadmap system is a different level. It's not something you'll do with your clients or an exercise review. This is for your information as a way to strategically understand how to deconstruct and really understand personal performance and how to systematically create change with your client, to write new code for mind, brain, and behavior, and to perform under pressure. Now, here's a word for the limits of algorithms. From then Harris County, I'm in Houston, Harris County Judge Emmett Smith. He said this, for Houston, Texas, 3 500-year floods in 3 years means we're either free and clear for the next 1,500 years or something has seriously changed about our algorithms. Now, science is about patterns, the fundamental laws and principles that form the foundation of our lives and world. Our brains are pattern-seeking organs. Many of the methods to facilitate change can be contrary to the way our mind and brains work. So it's not about having the answer. Since our operating system is unconscious and not directly accessible anyhow, but having an informed framework to ask the right question and an evidence-based system to facilitate strategic change for best results. this is what we get paid for as mentor coaches. This brings our joy, our sense of effectiveness to help our client create an optimum performance story. When Dr. Helen Czerski was studying physics at Cambridge, she was in her grandmother's kitchen looking at textbooks and charts of quantum mechanics. She is very well known in this area. Her grandmother looked at her material and said, "What can you do when you know that?" Well, Dr. Czerski spent an expert lifetime answering her Nana's question and the unspoken follow-up question that she knew her Nana thought but kindly didn't say as she waited for the answer. And why should I care? So, we're about to answer Nana's two questions, spoken and unspoken. So first, and this is in your outline. It's an annotated outline, as you've seen, so the essential things are there. A state of mind is like a software program that determines what we perceive, how we process information, and how we respond. Like any actual software program, our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what happens, what it means, what to do, even what registers. Each mindset is its own software system, complete and internally consistent. This is where we have to think about how do you break a script. Mindsets frame an ongoing process. Mindsets include powerful beliefs that inform the stories that we write about ourselves. A simple example, researchers at Norwegian University Science and Technology School have recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the physical world. In other words, the human brain operates like a Google map. So when a new situation arrives, boom, a different map is booted up. We have several states of mind or mindsets for different situations. This, I think, explains how important it is to understand the context and framing for different situations from our client's perspective, and to have a cohesive story to organize and direct that series of map for the client to be able to do that. Now, state always comes first, the state of mind. That's what boots up a particular mindset. Then strategy and story. A state of mind is a software program with predetermined meanings, connections, internal association. Within a state of mind, just as within any software program, the patterns are predictable and consistent. When Susan gets angry with somebody on the executive team, she's likely to become more authoritative and demand better performance. When Robert is confronted with a challenging task, he's going to engage an attachment pattern to get somebody to make a decision that he will then sign off on. These will be consistent. They're not conscious, not necessarily logical. This systematic approach that we have as coaches to break the script, or at least to question the script, directly addresses the default mode of algorithms played out in relationships, behaviors, and emotions. This is what we're listening for, the process of what the client is describing instead of just the content. To revise the story, we have to understand together with the client that script and then have a systematic way to address change, to recognize and own the process, to assess what to do differently, and to create a systematic way of change. That's the overview of the roadmap system that we'll get to. So a default mode, the script, has its own continuity, and we feel comfortable when things are certain. We're uncomfortable with change when we activate new processes or even take a step into the new or different or unknown. It disrupts things, and it's uncomfortable. We'll come back to that because that's something I think we need to appreciate for each client, each in their own way. But that's how we learn. We don't learn something new when we follow the script and it works. A stimulus, such as a memory, a thought, a person, a place, can instantly shift our attention. Once we focus on the stimulus, it boots up a state of mind to then determine how we perceive and process everything that follows. A very simple example here. Whenever we have an activation of a certain part of our brain, let me say this a different way. Our brain registers exactly the same way, same kind of activation with anxiety or excitement. Very different feelings, but exactly the same activation pattern. Now, how we frame that with a client, for example, from the beginning, if we frame it as anxiety, danger, better head for cover, it's a threat, it boots up a very, instantly boots up a very different mindset. If we frame it as challenge, as opportunity, and then begin to collaboratively look at the next step, it's a totally different mindset that will create new neuronal connections and pathways. The first goes down already existing ones. And that's sort of the distinction between a problem focus, which goes down existing pathways, and a possibility focus. So how we immediately help our client frame in a collaborative way, in a positive way, to look at co-creating in a stepwise way. Now, two crucial elements in performance become how to boot up an optimum mindset, and then how to develop skills within that mindset for the best results. To enhance capacity and performance requires deliberate practice and systematic execution for optimum performance. We're going to examine both of those in detail in our third seminar. For right now, our brain rewires by focused attention on two things: possibilities and new experiences. Focus on new experiences and repetition then can encode new learning in our neural circuitry. So here's a simple application: the surface and shadow stories. The surface story is our usually logical, conscious interaction, our aspiration. This is what I want from my, these are my goals. This is what I want to do to develop my practice. The shadow story that can ghostwrite behaviors, and this is from the 90 to 95% of our operating system that's automatic and unconscious, and it can work great. You don't have to think about it. You drive the same way to work every day. After a month or so, you don't have to think about it. You can listen to an audio book. So that basic behavior is useful, but then it, if it has negative aspects, it can get in the way. Now, here's an example. When the surface and shadow stories go in opposite directions, stuckness can occur. Let's say the surface story sees money as security, freedom, pleasure, or worth, depending on what the individual's meaning is that's been around a long time. But the same brain may be wired to link to the shadow story of greed or evil or selfish or I can't do it or I'm not made to have significant money. So here's a simple example of a surface story. I want to generate more income and create wealth. Now, if a counter is by the shadow story, I don't think I have what it takes, or a kind of bargaining of, well, I'm not ready yet. I got to wait for my website, I need to get confident, I need to get all those limiting assumptions. Those aspects are a shadow story that can interfere. We want one thing, but unconsciously may do something else. This is where we come in as coaches. We're listening for that surface story as well as the shadow story, and finding ways to engage for both of us to listen together. The biggest obstacle that keeps us from having what we want is the story we create about why we can't have what we want. I can't find the time. I can't really find time to work out. I'm not sure it would be worth it. I may not know what to do, or I've got to wait until I get comfortable. I need to be confident before I start this. That's not the way it works. So here's a discussion briefly about two brains and top-down and bottom-up. We have two operating systems with competing interests. We want to save for the future. We want to enjoy spending money. We want to be healthy. Yet we want to spend something now and want the cheesecake with strawberry topping. When we write two stories simultaneously that go in opposite direction, it's not a metaphor, it's brain chemistry. One example is the reward center of the brain, the nucleus accumbens. It releases a pleasure chemical, dopamine, with anticipation, for example, of a purchase. The pain center of the brain, the insula, responds when we have to part with our money to pay. This is why credit card companies happen to know something about this, because we spend 25% more when it's abstract, when we spend with a credit card rather than actual money or transfer electronically. So the bottom-up system, the intuitive system, is automatic. It's immediate. It's basically our intuitive blinks. It is automatic. So we can make errors of intuitive or emotional origin. This is what we're listening for as coaches. The top-down system, the logical, conscious seat of self-control for executive functioning and reasoning, this determines voluntary attention and choice in the consideration and deliberation of how we make decisions. So these, and this is, I know it's too many words and too theoretical. We're going to apply all this to make it make sense, but this is kind of some building stones for ways I think it will be helpful to understand a little bit more about how the mind and brain works, because that's what we're working with. When the bottom-up system prevails, this is the intuitive system, decisions can shift toward impulsivity. Now, this also occurs when we may not be as regulated or may be a little bit on tilt, because that can give easier access to an impulsive response. Also, a challenging problem, and that we're listening for as coaches, the unconscious biases are there from that bottom-up system without conscious awareness even from the top-down system. And awareness of these two aspects are important to look at in terms of balance, and especially for us to be aware how so many things can lower a threshold to resilience so that there is a greater inclination toward impulsivity. So fatigue, tiredness, overwhelm, so many things we need to be aware of, because one of the major things we do is help our clients regulate a state of mind so that they have a groundedness, a centeredness to be able to consider what's the best decision. So to Nana's question, why should you care? Well, it's all crucial for practice and skill development and optimum performance. So let's look at this in a particular perspective about focus. This is, remember, what we ask our client to begin with. What would you like us to focus on in this session? An example, a pro tennis player was having an outstanding season in her career. We met just before she left for Wimbledon, where she was one of the top seeds, and she had just started having difficulty with her serve, which is why we met. Her usual powerful, flawless serve was a little bit off. I mean, even 1 or 2% at her level was noticeable. I asked her to take us detailed frame by frame through her usual flow pattern of serve, like just the 10 seconds that she did that. Then to describe what she was experiencing or noticing now that was different. When she got to the point of tossing the ball in the air, she had an instantaneous flash of her coach looking at her critically. There had been an incident that had disrupted their usual harmony, and this is exactly what she... This literal nanosecond of moving from her flow state of motor memory, of not thinking about it, because in sports, if you think about it, even for a nanosecond, it's called a choke. This procedural process that had become automatic, that instant disrupted her well-grooved pattern. She then could address this and instantaneously moved to the usual flow instead of letting that nanosecond disrupt that. She hit the ball slightly differently at her level of play. This meant everything until she addressed it about sustaining the flow. It wasn't about practicing a better tennis serve. It was sustaining the flow. So the power is in the focus. Our unconscious mind doesn't distinguish positive or negative. It doesn't recognize future versus past. The unconscious mind only focuses on here and now. This is the power of selective attention. Our brain works like a camera. Out of all the possibilities, what you choose to focus on determines the awareness and aligns the energy field of the brain for attention. Attention holds the key to choice architecture. Everything in our discussion with that client during this session will follow the focus and to develop that. Successful performance execution depends on directing and sustaining focus to a specific choice and ignoring others. Now, here's a kind of a goofy application, but it makes the story come alive. My wife gifted both of us with enrollment in the BMW Racing School in Greenville, South Carolina for our 10th anniversary. It was a fascinating and masterful application of performance sciences. We went through so many aspects of driving challenges with pro racers over 3 days. The first basic they taught us before we ever got into the car for that next hour for sharp turns at high speeds was to say, look at where you want to go, not at what you want to avoid. Since our brains follow our eyes, when we look at where we want to go, we create a successful turn even at high speed under pressure. If we look at the obstacle we want to avoid, our brain follows our eyes there too, and we get what we focus on. Focus on avoiding the obstacle, you'll regularly hit it. What does this mean for a client? What would you like us to focus on today? Well, the client. Well, let me tell you about the problem. That would mean, if you're working with me in mentor coaching, we've already had the agreement before we ever began day one, session one, that I've asked permission to interrupt the client at any point because there's no reason to further etch a pathway that's not working. And I have regularly gotten permission to do that. May I interrupt you if I feel it would be helpful for both of us to look at something at that instant? And inevitably, they say yes. And I give them permission to interrupt me. It has to go both ways. So when we focus on avoiding the obstacle, you regularly hit it. So let me tell you about the problem. Let's look at the possibility. And then what's the first step for that? So when a coach focuses on what not, let's say a professional athletic coach focuses on what not to do with players, it can become a prelude to a choke. An individual getting analytical, even self-critical, disrupts the flow of this deliberate practice and performance, of that automatic bottom-up system, to impose thinking about it. You think about it for one nanosecond, can be a choke. So This most fundamental principle is one we know quite well from neuroscience and quantum physics. You get what you focus on, not what you want. So look at where you want to go. The next step, the next curve, ultimately 20 years from now. Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympian until this current Olympics, describes the significance of focus for him. He said, when I'm focused, there is not one single thing, person, anything that can stand in my way of doing something. If I want something bad enough, I'm going to focus and get there. New neuronal networks and pathways are created when we focus on possibilities and solutions. Already existing circuitry is further etched when we focus on problems. Even if you try to solve them, even having a better solution, a thousand better solutions, you've etched that pathway even further in someone's brain by doing that. This is how some people get stuck in therapy. This concept offers explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus is more effective than a problem focus. These brain connections literally become mind maps and subsequently influence the reality that we see. Now, we mold our brain pathways and synaptic connections by what we focus on. We choose what we pay attention to. This may begin early on in work with the client to look at what the client can determine and focus on that and let go of what they can't determine. This refocuses on what can be potentially effective, and the strategy can go from there. A simple example is that rather than focusing on obstacles that hold us back, we refocus on things to move forward and the positive connections. Now, let's talk about something I think is so basic in our work with clients, ourselves, before we begin with a client to get grounded and centered, to be fully focused with access to all of our states of mind and all that information. So whatever you do to get grounded and centered before you begin that initial engagement each time with a client. So let's talk about regulating states of mind and managing emotions. A state of mind is a particular set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. So a key element of mastery is to become aware of various states of mind with a particular focus on what state works best for what purpose. The greatest challenge is to regulate states of mind through various emotional triggers and charged situations. It is the most important variable to determine successful performance of any type, athletic to intellectual. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach. The meaning determines behavior. So by changing the state of mind, you change the behavior. So here's what we know now. A gap in performance has more to do with the mindset than with motivation, intelligence, and training. When a performer in any endeavor, athlete, surgeon, executive, coach, has practiced essentially the same thousands of hours as the next person, optimum performance is determined by a specific mental state for that performance. So, as I mentioned, some things that can lower the threshold to respond perhaps more emotionally. Preset meaning, like certain biases, depleted energy, distraction, emotional overwhelm, too many choices, significant emotional charge, like specific triggers, or after ineffectiveness or powerlessness. Here's a simple example that kind of illustrates this. In a study reported, you don't need to know where it was reported, it was decent journal. Eight parole judges were studied for 3 years for their decision-making regarding applications granted for parole. The average parole grant by these eight judges over 3 years was 65% of the requests were granted. Now, just before noon, just before the end of the day, when blood glucose was lowest, their approval rate dropped to the single digits. At these times of low blood glucose and greater fatigue, they resorted to more critical and judgmental thinking. Just after each meal, 65%, average 35%. I'll tell you a story of an application of this in a moment, but I want to get to a case illustration of this. Here's one example. One pro athlete I work with came to incorporate and apply everything we talked about in regulating states of mind and entering the flow of performance mindset in his all-pro career. After every play, he learned to automatically say, "The football is a game. It's an episodic. You know, you do a play, and then a bunch of stuff happens, and then you do another play. It's not a game of flow like basketball or polo or you know." So he learned that after every play, just before the ball snapped, he would say to himself, "Reset." He knew that in order not to have excitement from a really great play or disappointment or boredom or any distraction, he had to reset immediately. He got in state. In that grounded and centered state, he had access to all of his incredible skills for optimum performance. So any disruptive emotion, a big win, a big loss, an upset, can hijack attention and disrupt flow. So we need to find a way to help our clients manage emotions and regulate states of mind, particularly at a time like this. So I want to reference now, as we talk about neural rewiring, how we rewire our brain for emotional triggers, look at the neural conditioning chart in the exercise section of the outline. I think it's page 14. I want us to address, before we end our seminar today, I want to address self-regulation in a systematic way. And to illustrate the neural conditioning chart, I'll tell you exactly how I developed it. It's more sophisticated now, but a client I'll call Barbara paused during one of our mentor coaching sessions, focusing on her executive leadership, to mention, sort of almost parenthetically, that she was about to be distracted over the upcoming Thanksgiving holidays and looked forward to getting back and resuming her new project with her company. And I kind of sensed a momentary discomfort and asked about her expectation for the holidays. She said, "Well, you know, I would like to talk about that." She said she was aware of a pattern in which every time she goes home to her family, it's one major holiday a year. This year, as we were talking, it was Thanksgiving. She noticed the same problem. And she was really embarrassed and had some reluctance and difficulty discussing. She said, "Well, here goes. We have a big family gathering where my parents, brother and sister, and their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days. I resolve before I leave, this time is going to be different. I will not get into arguments or struggles with my parents and brother and sister particularly. I really focus on being balanced and not resorting to squabbles and upset. I can usually last most of the first day, but then I just kind of wear down. Something happens and I lose it. I get in a fight with one of my family. Then it seems to escalate. Then I'm in a fight with all of them, and we're at a standoff for the rest of the holiday time. It doesn't happen except when I'm there with them. I can maintain my cool all other times, even with telephone visits. And certainly with my family and my executive position. Can you help me with this?" Well, I first said I understand how frustrating that must be for her to want an enjoyable holiday with her family and have things work out otherwise. And she really agreed with that. I said, at the time you're in the middle of that upset and you're in arguments with them, what is the age of your conversation? And she immediately knew what I was talking about. She didn't need an explanation. She said, early adolescent. I'm 13 or 14, instantly and totally at that time. I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit. I'm saying and doing the things I did when I was 13. Barbara wanted a close, meaningful relationship with her parents and her sibling. She understandably wanted to share her personal and professional successes and experiences and hear from her sibs and their partners about the parents' transition. But when a state was triggered by that emotion, she only wanted to be right. She wanted to be heard. She wanted to express her anger at not being understood. Exactly what she experienced at beginning 13 and 14, the beginning of her adolescence. I asked her what she was aware of that triggered her reactions. She began to describe a particular look from her dad, a word from her mother, a gesture from her brother that would instantly create her reactive mode. For example, when I asked her for specifics about this, not a zoom out, but when her dad rolled his eyes in a particular way, she was instantly transported back to that time of anger and resentment for feeling controlled and criticized, not being good enough, expecting negative judgment. So, and she mentioned a word from her mother. So I recommended that she schedule a time with herself, an appointment with herself, maybe at least 20 or 30 minutes, to do a brainstorming session, to get really grounded and centered, and to write a list of each of the emotional triggers that she was aware of from each of her family, and to be sure to stay grounded and centered, to be an observer, and just write in a column the list of those triggers, not triggering herself, not getting into it, but just as an observer. And in a second column, I asked her actually to put a page. I think I was ahead of it enough to think about it. I asked her to do a page with, you'll see, the neuroconditioning chart. There are three lines, four columns. I asked her to do the first column of the specific emotional trigger and the second column of exactly what her reaction or feeling or behavior was to that trigger. And I, again, emphasize not to trigger herself. So whatever was in column two, thoughts, feeling, behavior, would include her immediate automatic reaction. This was her age 13 and 14 time capsule. I suggested then that she schedule a second time, an appointment with herself, about the same time, to go with those two columns and to create a third and a fourth column. A cue to initiate the process, to remind her to get grounded and centered. She and I told her, I don't think you have access to the Roger Reed store. I'll tell you that in a bit. She used the cue of touching her ring, and that meant to get grounded and centered. A focus phrase to align the energy field of her brain. Hers was relaxed and powerful. And a physiology like a deep breath, to breathe in relaxation, like we talked about with Laurie Hernandez, a picture, a cue, and a relaxation. This mantra may be the same sequence for getting grounded and centered. The cue, the focus, the physiology, that's the mantra. It should take 2, 3, 4 seconds, and I encouraged her to practice it. To practice doing it so that it would become more automatic. And then in the fourth column to put what would be her ideal response when she experienced that cue. When she saw her dad roll her eyes, what would be her present day response rather than her age 13 response? So that cue was the mantra rather, was the transition to the ideal behavior. So rather than being in that 13 to 14 and beyond, time capsule, column two, She had an ideal behavior planned already. So she sent me the initial draft of these four columns, and I emphasized the purpose of the first two columns was to cue her radar to recognize the emotional trigger, column one, but also the resultant state change and the content of that state as quickly as possible so that she could get grounded and centered, column three. Then she could engage her ideal response, pre-plan, for each emotional trigger, column four. In our first session after the Thanksgiving holiday, I was eager to hear how it went. She immediately began the session saying it was the best holiday she'd ever had with her family. There were times of challenge, but even times when she, and I emphasize, you know, this is not the NBA. You have an unlimited number of timeouts. If you feel like you need to pause and go to the bathroom, splash water on your face, take a walk, or just pause and say, I'll get back, she could regulate herself to get in that ideal state. And she noticed that she did that several times. And she had repeated that mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology, so many times that it had become sort of familiar so she could apply it with her family. And she noted about her Thanksgiving experience. That was incredible, but it was really hard work. And my response was, I understand how hard and how successfully you work. The only thing harder, as you already know, is not doing it. So that's just one application for what we're talking about, the how to rewire with neural triggers. So look at that neural conditioning chart, and I would suggest trying it to see what you think, to specify certain triggers that set you off, for example, and what the immediate behavior or feeling or thoughts are based on that cue, and then develop your own mantra, your own cue and focus and physiology, and your own ideal behavior. So here's an example of putting that together in a different context. Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, inherited a team that ranked 217th in free throw percentage. That was out of 217 teams in their division nationwide. So during practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. He asked them to go to the free shot line, dribble the ball, have a focus phrase that would align the energy. You didn't talk about it in this way. Have a focus phrase such as relaxed and smooth, and take a deep breath at the same time to breathe in relaxation. So during the 2 or 3 or 4 seconds that it took to dribble the ball, they did this before each shot. And then, in addition, because you don't get to line up and shoot your 30 best free shots in a game and count ones that made it, he would blow a whistle and have players immediately go to the free shot line, do 2 free shots. If they made it, they got a break. If they didn't, everybody did 4 laps. After 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. So this is the application of being aware of a cue, a focus, a physiology. The cue would be to dribble, or as Barbara, to touch a ring. And I'll tell you other stories of other cues that have worked, even some personal ones. But and then to have an ideal behavior. So just as a summary, because I want to reserve a few minutes for discussion, this neuroconditioning chart can allow conscious recognition of an emotional trigger that can otherwise instantaneously create a state change to an old state of mind with all of the inherent feelings and behaviors and beliefs. So now in summary, column 1 and 2, the emotional trigger and usual response are simply to recognize more quickly, objectively, that an emotional trigger and a state change is occurring. Cue your radar to recognize this as quickly as possible means that you can observe the process. This is what we're doing with clients. This is what we can develop self-awareness and help the client develop self-awareness. Rather than staying stuck in the content of that column two, the time capsule, because usually it will feel to you, to the client, that whatever is in that time capsule, the negative self-talk, all that, it would seem that that's what caused the issue. That's the result. The result is stopping oneself with that trigger of a state change, a signal of anxiety, or whatever the uncomfortable affect is that's not, then immediately go to that time capsule, and it's like, we need to work on this. No, the process is what needs to be addressed so that someone can regulate state of mind and not fall into that time capsule, because it doesn't change. By definition, the things that were in that time capsule for Barbara, they were still exactly as they were at 13 and 14. So an ideal response then for each particular emotional trigger can be pre-planned, and the mantra can be the way station. So as you do this repeatedly, you'll notice two things. The first, that as you repeat your mantra, the cue, the focus phrase, the physiology, such as deep breathing, you'll notice ultimately that the cue alone will be sufficient to induce a grounded and centered state. You won't have to do the focus phrase and the physiology each time. This is the first part of neural conditioning. You've rewired your brain to use an automatic cue to induce a state. So as you move through all four steps to engage an ideal response, when you repeat it enough and go across horizontally, it'll rewire your brain. That's neural conditioning. Ultimately, the initial emotional trigger will automatically couple with a balanced state of mind and the ideal response when you've worked it. The trigger won't be triggering. It can be a cue for an ideal behavior, for a default behavior. This is the hard work miracle. Your brain has rewired its operating system. Now, one final caveat. Elite performers in business, sports, and the arts know and live the wisdom that the more enjoyable the experience, the better the performance will be. And this is from the dedication for a new book of mine that just came out to my favorite grandmother, who said it very simply, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So our next seminar, we're going to talk about the neuroscience of peak performance and look at confidence, mindfulness, deliberate practice, and unlearning. Hold on, I'm going to put us on. We're in discussion mode. Any questions, additions, or clarifications? Any clarifications or anything you'd like to add or ask? We've got just 2 or 3 minutes. I'd hope to have longer, but I'm interested in how you're hearing this. One suggestion I'd have is after each seminar, you write down, would you manage the background noise and unmute only when you're about to talk because there's some technostatic. Write down the most important thing you're taking away. I'll talk about the importance of output channel later, but is there a question or a comment or clarification that would be helpful? Anyone? One study, and I look for the simplest examples of things, about writing down something or even saying it out loud, puts it in an output channel in our brain. This is why, perhaps, if you follow the simple coaching model, The next to last question you ask the client is, what's the most important takeaway you're having from this session? And then, based on that, what do you commit to do? So that's what I'm asking now. If any of you have a takeaway, or to write it down yourself, I know some of you will be are doing this on recording because of schedule. Write down the most important thing. Here's a study that illustrates that. University of Waterloo did a study in which a large number of volunteers read the same passage from a book. Half read it out loud, half read it silently. They then gave the same test to everyone. Those who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. They had put it in an output channel. It made it more attainable and retainable when they did that. So that's a part of a reason, I think, why it's so beneficial for our clients to summarize in a brief sentence the most important thing they're taking away, individual, group, couples, whatever, and then to look at what they commit to do. Because once there are some studies I won't bore you with and we don't have time for, and you said thankfully, there are some studies that show that when we put something in an output channel in terms of a commitment, we're way more likely to follow through because it involves how we see ourselves and our identity because we said it or wrote it out loud and somebody else is witness. So
I just want to share a comment that you made that I put two stars next to on the notes that I was writing.
Of course, I'm going for three and four next time, but go ahead.
It's look at where you want to go, not at what you want to avoid. And
yep.
Just that phrase alone, of all the things, I mean, it's meant three pages of notes that I have here, but that is the central piece. And then also that self-critique disrupts flow or creates a choke. So I love that, and I'm going to apply it immediately.
Thank you very much for sharing that. This is, you mind sharing your first name?
Oh, sure, Amy.
Okay, thank you very much. That's helpful, and I appreciate that. I'm glad it was helpful. I know we're out of time. Any other comment or addition before we sign off for this seminar? Well, thank you very much. If you have, those of you who haven't sent, if you have responses to either or both of those questions, fire it off in an email. And if you have anything you want to be sure that we add to the hopper, let me know as well. We'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very, very much. Hope you guys have a great week. See you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.